Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Pilot TV podcast and this, our long-awaited spoiler special for the OA. Over the course of this podcast, we'll be performing the movements, plugging into the tree internet, consulting our psychic octopus and cultivating our mind flowers as we delve deep into the multidimensional mysteries of Britt Marling and Zalbat Manglij's incredible series. Joining me today is my regular pilot co-host, a man who could be, in many ways, this reality's alternate version of me, given that we are, in fact, both bald white men, a body that I could jump into if I wished to suddenly be awash in celebrity friends. He is Pilot TV's very own old knight, Mr. Boyd Hilton.
Thank you very much. I think we should apologise for the fact that it is two bald, old, white men, middle-class, one might add, because the only reason Terry's not here is because she hasn't had time to watch the bloody show yet. Interestingly, we asked her questions to send us to people to DM us questions. Did you see? One of the questions is, why the hell hasn't Terry White watched this show yet?
Yeah, that's a legitimate question.
So, there, apologies for it just being us blokes.
Is your middle name, Boyd, does it begin with a B?
No.
So we can't call you BBH?
No, that's annoying, isn't it?
That is a shame.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
I'll be honest, that's quite disappointing.
Yeah.
Are you feeling up to this?
I'm up to it. I'm definitely up to it, yeah. I'm both exhausted because... I've just interviewed Zal and Britt, the creators. And I didn't want to do it, like, linearly, if you like. I didn't want to go through, beginning, middle, end.
Yeah.
So I hopped around all the time. I hope they're okay with it. But, we could talk about it all night, couldn't we? There's so much to talk about. So I don't know where we begin. My theory... I've come up with an idea of where to begin our discussion about it, though, which is, the very first scene of part two is there's a title card that says 7 hours, 46 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
And you see this confusing image of a skateboarder at night skateboarding down some road. And then on the side of the road is Britt Marling as the OA in this dress. And then it turns out to be a dream of Kareem, the character Kareem. But what is it 7 hours, 46 minutes earlier? Now, I didn't ask them that because I thought they probably wouldn't want to answer it necessarily. But some people have suggested that it roughly coincides with the actual running time of the whole of part two, but doesn't exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I think the exact running time, official running time, is something like 7 hours, 26 minutes, but it's pretty close.
Now, we didn't ask them about that, but we did ask them a number of other searching questions.
Yeah.
But before we do that, I should say, anyone who listens to the podcast regularly will know that obviously we're huge fans of the show. And we have little doubt that you've all watched it by now, unless you're Terry, in which case you haven't. However, if you have not seen all the way to the end of season two, then please turn this podcast off immediately and hie thee to Netflix and go and watch it. We will be getting very plot heavy in this podcast, and spoilers will be flying at you from every conceivable dimension. So this is your last warning to turn back. Still with us? Then let's continue. There is a lot to talk about with this show, but really, who better to talk about it than Britt Marling and Zalbat Manglij themselves, the creators of the show. So using the power of transdimensional communication via a device that allows us to project both our voices and consciousness across realities, it's called Skype, we called up Britt and Zal to ask them all our burning questions about season two, and this is how it went.
Just in general to start with, I mean, we're going to get into deep spoiler territory, by the way. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of it, just the response to the whole thing after working on it solidly for 2 years and dominating your lives, how do you feel about the response to it? And have you monitored that and how, you've blown minds worldwide, basically, with part two of the OA?
We actually don't monitor it. We don't think about it that much. We're trying to catch our breath after working for so hard and trying to live like normal lives.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the sort of disappointing part of it is so in working like that so intensely for really the last 4 years, because we didn't take a break in between part one and part two. So all of a sudden you finish and you're like reeling and then you're like, oh my God, I haven't been to the dentist in 5 years. And like my car no longer starts and I'm getting evicted from the house I rent. And suddenly like real life comes crashing back in a way that is gobsmacking. So
that's what we've been focusing on. And then I think just like preparing our minds and bodies for if a part three happens, sort of the excitement of like, you know, putting on the scuba gear again and going underwater.
Right. I mean, and of course, I mean, that was going to be my last question. Was part three has to happen, doesn't it? So, but I guess you can't. You can give us that exclusive right now if you want, but it just has to happen. You can't leave us dangling like this.
Well, I don't think there's any guarantee that three will happen. You know, I think it has to be. I would like to make one, but you know.
Okay. Let's get into the nitty gritty then, if that's okay. First of all, I'm reminded of I wrote down a quote from Dr. Percy that he says to the OA in that scene where he's about to show her what he's been working on in his secret room, and he says, "What you see in there can be very challenging. Are you sure you're ready?" And I feel like that could be like an announcement to the viewer for the whole of the show, really, in a way. Is that in your mind slightly when you wrote that line?
No, that's a good thing that you found. I don't think so. You know, you have to understand that for us, maybe I remember the first time you read some of the, like a new idea, or Britt and I talk about something, or one of those ideas like hits us for the first time. That's like intense or exciting or different. But for us, we've been with this for so long. It's hard for us to see it the way, I guess, just the viewer sees it. Like, so we don't think it's hard to digest. I don't know, you know.
But at the same time, I remember when we were writing that scene and we had, you know, I mean, what's fun about making a long form story is you see over time how things play out for the audience. And I think one of the things we did learn in making part one is that sometimes if you just suggest to the audience, like, okay, I'm going to hold your hand here and we're going to walk into an unknown space together, that the audience feels in safe hands and can for a moment sort of allow themselves to go into territory that is new and actually, you know, sort of be open to it. So I think it's really interesting that you picked out that line in particular, because I remember thinking like Hap should prepare us, you know?
Right. And I remember when I was lucky enough to be on set, you were saying, I brought up the issue, the thing about the title, the opening titles arriving so late in that very first chapter. And then you said, oh, we've got spine tingling moments like that, definitely in part two. And you certainly did. So, for example, just to jump straight into Old Night, for example, this extraordinary octopus consciousness. When you hit upon that as a visually and as a dramatic, as an incredible scene that you build up to in that episode, you must have known that is going to be a spine tingling moment for the viewer. And what is, and you, am I right in thinking that you'd read a book about octopus consciousness that was the inspiration for that? But why particularly did you decide it's got to be an octopus?
You know, that's such an interesting question. I think Zal and I have long, sort of for the last couple of years, been interested in the idea of just interspecies communication, and also interested in the idea that, like, you know, we humans have a lot of hubris. We really assume that like our intelligence is the most interesting or the most evolved because we can sort of talk to each other about it. And, you know, because the octopus doesn't have a voice, we can't imagine that it has a kind of sophistication or a way of living or exploring or being in the world that may in very many ways be beyond ours. We did read this book called, a couple interesting books. One was The Hidden Life of Trees, which was really beautiful on the subject of how trees communicate and forests work. And then Other Minds, which was about cephalopod, you know, consciousness and how almost alien it is in the way it operates as a creature. It its brain is sort of in all of its arms. So unlike how we operate, we sort of think something and then the thought travels and then we move. There's a sort of break in our thinking and our movement. For the octopus, it's think moving. It like those things are combined. And so we were so interested reading all of that and thought, how is there a way that we can walk the audience into a space through Nina's mediumship where we can contemplate again all the amazing forms of intelligence around us that we tend to dismiss or ignore?
I think it was also a great way to dramatize entering someone's life that's in at full speed or in full motion. I sometimes imagine if there was another version of me in another sort of universe, and I entered his body, does he have kids? Does he have, what's his job? Is he writing a novel right now? You would then go read 100 pages of that novel that he's written. And that's pretty intense. And we wanted to dramatize the idea that OA was going to come do something that for Nina, she had spent years sort of perfecting, which is this sort of mediumship with an octopus as a sort of like, an evening out at this Syzygy nightclub. And there was something just like really full on. And I thought it told the story.
Oh, God, it did. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess was it in a way like the whole setting of San Francisco helps, doesn't it, with this? Because I was thinking, because like having this outlandish nightclub with all the Russians in it and with these like half naked guys wandering, the whole film thing felt that added to that whole thing that actually you prepared us for this mind blowing visual of the octopus and tapping into Nina. But the whole setting helped. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like the whole setting of San Francisco helps the whole of part two in a way, in all kinds of different ways.
Well, we have a friend, Michael Tolkien, the writer who made Escape at Dannemora, and he was showing us photographs of himself. He's a burner, which means he likes to go to Burning Man every year.
Oh, yeah.
Showing us all these photographs from Burning Man, including one of the founders of Google, dressed up as if, dressed up to the point of disappearing into the sort of Burning Man landscape. And the idea that that's also a part of San Francisco is both unsettling and exciting. There's something about it that really spoke to us. And so for us, Syzygy was a little bit of that, underground.
Right.
And then we were so lucky. I mean, this is where like it's really a collaborative art form. And we were lucky on part two that a lot of people brought their A game. So Jonathan Jansen, our location manager, he was able to find this old cell phone store that then opened up on the back behind the cell phone store was an abandoned chocolate shop from the 1930s. And that is what Syzygy is. We put the seamstresses in the front part, which is where the cell phone store was. And then we built that sliding wall. And all of a sudden you go inside the chocolate shop and that's where the nightclub is. And so that's something we had written, but you could easily not found the right location for it. And so we were very lucky that things really aligned in part two to really tell the story over and over again. Because without space or location, it just becomes kind of, it's grasping at something. And I think that the way that it's photographed and that actual space, holds these secrets. Does that make sense, Britt?
I was just going to say that you were right. I love what you're saying. And I also love what Boyd was saying about San Francisco being such a character, because I think that's an element of the film noir. The place really becomes character. And Zal's right. We were very lucky in our production designer, John Goldsmith, in Jonathan Jansen, who was location scout, because I think a lot of these scenes it would have been hard for them to stand up if we hadn't found the spaces that held a sense of mystery that makes that possible. You find a space that's just a little bit off or sort of ordinary, and suddenly the scene collapses in that space, no matter how hard the actors are performing,
Right, absolutely. Yeah, like it's like the production design and the look of it just makes it all, you kind of do buy into it, even though what you're watching is, you've kind of never seen anything like it in a way. And the other thing, of course, in that scene, when Old Knight is tapping into Nina's mind, we then get this incredible foreshadowing, don't we? This bit where she's transported to the flight on the plane and we see the kind of the back of, presumably this is the big foreshadowing of the final moments of the whole of part two, isn't it? And did you always have in mind that you would foreshadow that, that there'll be the clues that you could go back and see once you've seen the ending, the extraordinary ending with the third dimension, if you like, that you're going to have moments that would lead us into that?
I don't know what you're talking about, but
we can talk about the ending, right?
I mean, I
guess, we can talk about the ending, but we can't talk about what's being foreshadowed.
But can say that, like, I think all over the place we try to do sort of small hooks that connect. You know, right. Like in part one, Homer has his NDE and he's running through the sort of hospital-like space, and you know, he as he's crawling through that tunnel in the beginning, it seems like a classic NDE light at the end of the tunnel, and then some weird hand pops up. And then, of course, all those questions are answered in part two when, you know, he is Dr. Roberts in this asylum space that is the space of his near-death experience, and ends up putting his own hand up in the ceiling at some point and feeling around for what might be another Homer up there. So we do try to, you know, make sure that at some point there's visual proof that everything connects.
Right, absolutely. And as you mentioned, another big extraordinary moment I wanted to talk about is the tree internet idea. That amazing scene. I'm intrigued by how do you get that down? I think one of the themes that emerged from when I met you was the constant, I mean, in a way, struggle, but also joy of getting your ideas onto the script and then turned into visually the show. I mean, this must have been a particular challenge. How you got, A, where did the idea of the tree internet come from? B, how you then managed to make it work within the episode?
Well, the tree internet is something that I really like because I think it exceeded at least my imagination of it. Maybe Britt has a more sophisticated imagination. She was able to imagine it better. I thought that the end visuals were really stunning and are moving. I was very pleased with that. It's rare that I feel that way. Usually the ideas themselves feel a lot more potent or perfect than my limited execution. But I thought with the tree internet, there was a nice marriage of I don't know, style and story. But that tree internet's real. Britt, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we had been doing some, I think I mentioned earlier that the book, The Hidden Lives of Trees, which is really inspiring because you read that book and you realize we think we're so clever for coming up with the internet, but the trees have had their own internet, you know, communication system underground long before we ever came up with ours. And they use fungal networks to send messages back and forth to each other. And so all of that that you're watching is actually quite real, or is it inspired by what is real. And I think one of the things that I learned this go around that was really helpful is you have to, when you're doing scenes like that, where a lot is going to be done in VFX later, you have to figure out the piece that's tangible that you can hold on to in the filming. So for me, I was really adamant about us casting the voices that would become the voices of the tree internet. It was described in the script as 10,000 genderless whispers. We couldn't get 10,000 people into a recording booth, but we got 12 people and we sort of conducted them like a chorus, and we recorded those voices, you know, saying the sort of trees dialogue. And then on the day when I'm just hanging there in a harness in a big empty blue space and there's nothing around, we're playing that voice. And there is that to sort of react to in real time and create the feeling of something real transpiring. And then we all hold on to that later through the edit, through the VFX process, so that there's some, I guess, human tangible thread to pull through. We did a similar thing with Old Knight. I had a little ear thing in my ear, and we went and cast Old Knight's voice well ahead of time. And he was there on the day performing in the space with us so that it could create the feeling of a real dialogue happening.
And mediumship, because it's like those invisible earpieces really are like a voice in your head.
Yes, yeah.
Right. Right, that's brilliant. I mean, it looked absolutely beautiful, that scene. But also, I feel it's like a big, it feels like a big thematic moment, because the trees are telling you that to build a team, aren't they? And it feels like that's touching upon this theme of the individual versus the team, because the OA seems to know the path. It seems to already in certainly in the first series built her this group of, you know, the group of the kids and BBA. Whereas Hap, on the other hand, and I remember that right towards the end, she tells him he's lonely. There seems to be this big clash between being on your own and wanting to be with a group and wanting to. Is that a big theme of the show that came out of that particular scene touched upon?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big theme for us in general, because I think personally, I mean, I think Rick probably agrees, but speeches for myself, like. It's a big theme of living in the world right now, this idea that I think we're very alienated and very lonely and very isolated. And whenever we get a chance to be with a tribe or exist the way that I think, you know, we lived for hundreds of thousands of years as tribes, with a lot more equality, with a lot more companionship. I mean, I think that's... You go onto a college campus and people are smiling and they're happy. And I think they feel a lot more integrated with each other. I mean, of course, the alienation from capitalism and from modern life exists even on college campuses. But I'm just trying to give an example of, like, when we're with people, I mean, sometimes you feel it on a film set, though film sets are very hierarchical. There is something just nice about being with a group and doing things as a team or a family or a tribe. And that just seems so rare these days. We're obsessed with lone genius, with solitary rises, with individualism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that comes across completely as well in that big scene, that big confrontation between Hap and the OA at the end, where she because talking to Jason Isaacs, as far as he's concerned, and I guess he has to do this as a performer, you know. Happy's character isn't necessarily a villain or bad or anything, but I think she tells him that she exposes that flaw, that big flaw, that he kind of, you know, can't think about the impact of what he does on other people, and he, you know, that lone element to him feels key.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to bring up. I think Hap has this idea of the world that in his effort to know, you know, the whatever is the capital T truth, that any means justify the ends, and that everybody around him couldn't possibly be smart enough to understand what he's after. And therefore, you know, they're sort of at the mercy of his will. And I love that you picked up on the fact that, you know, Jason, being the tremendous actor that he is, doesn't, you know, he really just passionately believes from Hap's perspective that the science is everything, and that the science will ultimately be a liberator.
Right.
And so in some ways he's taking all of this pain on himself in order to ultimately, you know, give everybody the truth. You know, I think that's how part of how he approaches it. I think as writers and as performers, you have to try not to judge your characters. You know, you have to try to get inside them enough to understand why they're behaving the way they're behaving. And then just present that to the audience and let the audience bring the wisdom to the table. You know, you're just bringing characters.
Absolutely, yeah. The return of Riz Ahmed was a brilliant moment in part two, and a complete surprise, and I guess he's now even more of a mystery, that character, than ever. I don't want you to kind of give away anything about who he is or what he is apart from, but he seems to give key advice to BBA and her friends, and also seems to be key in looking after or helping the OA. Can you say any more about that? Or just, did you always plan maybe to have that character return just for that brief moment and then tantalize us with who or what he really is.
We definitely always plan to have him return. We saw that we really felt that that moment he spends with French in the house at the end of part one, you know, was meant to be a suggestion that there's more than meets the eye, you know. And we had hoped that some of the audience would ask the question, like, well, what's this FBI guy doing in the house? Like, how did he get in? Like, what, he just has a key, you know, or did he? And so I think some people were asking those questions, and hopefully seeing him again in chapter six felt like a worthwhile payoff of some of the questions they may have been asking.
I mean, I think that he also helps. He helps BBA and the boys, but he's also helping the audience sort of start to maybe, you know, solve the puzzle.
I quickly wanted to mention French because I loved the scene where he, you know, goes on his Grindr. Is it actually Grindr or Grindr style app? And
it's actual Grindr. We use actual, all apps. Right. Yeah, it's either Grindr or Scruff. I think it's Grindr. Yeah.
Right, right. Did you always have in mind that he would be gay, and that did you, and also to have a scene where it was such a brilliant done, because obviously you can fall into all kinds of traps where you make clear a character's gay, but it felt very real and very kind of match effect in one way, but also the guy he meets felt very just not real and non stereotypical, and then advances the story as well. That whole scene I thought was brilliantly handled, and also adds to the whole diversity of the whole, you know, the OA has one of the most diverse groups of characters, I think, in TV history. So was it a key for you that French would turn out to be gay?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, I think Andrew Haig directed that scene so beautifully.
Right.
I think it's beautifully done, and I think the actors did such a beautiful job with it. You know, Brandon Perea had never really done much acting before he got cast as French. So all of this is new to him. And I just think he did a great job at French being gay. I mean, I don't think we thought about it consciously from the very beginning, but I don't think we're not really big believers that we're writing these things. We feel more like we're uncovering them. An analogy Britt and I love to use amongst ourselves is the idea that we're gardeners in a garden and the story is blooming, or that we're archaeologists and digging out, you know, old bones or fossils. So we're just like dusting them, you know, digging and dusting to expose things that exist already. And so I think that either of the metaphors, if you use the garden metaphor, I think the idea of him being gay is, oh yeah, of course French is. Of course, French was hiding something. Of course, there's more than meets the eye to French, you know. Mm. But I think my favorite part of that whole thing is Steve's reaction to it.
Yes, yes.
You know,
it's perfect, isn't it? And I think it shows, because Steve's journey, to use that kind of cliche word, is incredible, isn't it? Because he starts out as a fairly, you know, a jock who's quite, you know, homophobic and all of that, and then he's now by the end of part one, he's been on a huge show, but by the end of part two, he's one of the most, I don't know, caring, open, passionately believing in the OA and the whole thing, isn't it? That's an interesting progression there, I think.
Yeah, it feels really organic. Like, it doesn't feel like there are levers or dials being pulled. It just feels like, you know, I mean, I guess maybe onto something we were talking about earlier, or that you mentioned earlier about a series or things we believe in, which is the idea that because Steve, this lone wolf character, meets a tribe, he gets to evolve in this way that he might have not evolved into had he not met the tribe. And you know, I think that all of us have felt that way, that we met a group of friends, or, you know, in our culture, I think it's more that you fall in love and you meet a lover and you feel that. But I think there's also something to be said for meeting a group of friends or a tribe and coming into your own or changing the direction of your life.
Absolutely, yeah. Can I ask you about the aspect ratios? So you've got three different aspect ratios reflecting the three different dimensions we've seen so far. Is that fair?
That is fair. And what's crazy about it is that we sort of wanted to delineate the dimensions through aspect ratio, but then, you know, it was funny, like right before we sort of finished the OA, we saw Homecoming, Sam Esmail's Homecoming,
yeah,
and he's with aspect ratios there too. And it's just funny because it's funny how these things happen in waves. Like, you know, I don't remember aspect ratios changing too much in the old days. And now they're another tool in a filmmaker's arsenal.
Yeah, right. Maybe in Brian De Palma films or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can I ask about the when the revelation of the mind flowers and the invisible river and the whole idea that within all of us, is this right, that within our consciousness we've all got these forking paths of God? And so is this part of the whole idea that you're trying to kind of expand our minds in a way as viewers of what you've created, and expand our idea of possibly what humanity is and what nature is and what and how we're all thinking? Is this part of this whole big plan?
I mean, it's hard to, I think what we can say about that, without saying too much, one of the funny things about science to me is that, you know, sometimes there's this perspective inside science that it is fact, you know, that it's like, this is the answer, period. And then, of course, like, you know, another decade passes and everything that was proven and sacrosanct is, you know, upended. There was a time when there was a great conviction that the Earth was the center of the universe and they were ready to burn anyone at the stake who suggested otherwise. And now, of course, we know that that is not the case. And so what I think is interesting about science is that it is, in the same way poetry or literature or there, it's always just our best guess and our attempt to describe what is ultimately in some ways undescribable. That's as much as I can say about that without revealing too much.
So I must jump to the ending to this extent. What struck me in a weird way by showing us that this new dimension is a film or TV set or whatever, and you're revealed as, we see you as Brit, and Jason Isaacs is married to you apparently, and all of that, like this extraordinary thing you have happen at the ending, it almost made it feel more real to me, the whole thing, because almost paradoxically, by showing us the artifice, a moment of artifice, you kind of underline that actually the whole thing is about storytelling and people building narratives with each other. Does that make sense? And was that part of your plan? And is it true that this was all part of, you had this big ending for this part two of your epic right from the start when you conceived the whole thing years ago?
Yes and yes. I think the way that you said it was really beautifully said. I mean, I don't think we need to add to it at all. It is, the OA, I think it's fair to say, is about storytelling. And the idea of narratives is quite potent these days. You know, there are competing narratives for, as Britt was saying, science is a very powerful narrative for understanding the world that we live in. Long-form stories are also powerful narratives for understanding the world that we live in. There's also, as Elodie says to OA, there are also these narratives between people. And maybe those narratives, there are echoes of them between in different parts of the multiverse. I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense. And did you always have apart from the big idea of that ending and the meta quality of it, the details, or for example, Britt being married to Jason Isaacs, was that, or did that happen later? And that was a kind of, it's kind of funny and weird and discombobulating and adds a whole new layer of stuff for us to think about.
I mean, that was there. I mean, one of the things that Elodie says that I love is the idea that when two people meet, the story can just be strong and it ripples or echoes out into the dimensions around, and the relationship can take on different sort of categorization or different name, but something similar is still being worked out between those people. And I think that, you know, on the ground level of our lives, you know, where we can't exactly perceive whether or not a multiverse exists day to day, but we do encounter people and sometimes feel like, wow, is this a pattern or relationship, style of relationship that I keep trying to work out, you know, inside many different relationships through time? So I think a lot of people, you know, you get the sense that there are certain scripts that you keep repeating, and you, and the question is, can you break outside of them eventually? I think a lot of people know what that feels like.
Yeah,
I mean, or at least I do.
You've said it before that once in a while you meet someone and it feels like it's the beginning of a long novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
What is that? You know, I guess Britt and I would say quite practically that feeling is a real feeling. Like it's not provable, but a lot of us have felt that feeling. You encounter someone, you feel like you've known them before, or you will know them for a long time, or that there is a lot to know. Is that their looks? Is that the way they smell? Is that something about their eyes? It feels like it's more than those things. And so I guess in our storytelling, we are trying to dramatize those kind of abstract feelings. I'll give you a good example that I think works well in part two, which is Homer waking up. You know, we work with amazing collaborators, and one of the great collaborators we work with is Andy Weissblum, who's our dear friend, but also an amazing editor. And I remember when he showed me his first assembly of Homer waking up in the glass elevator, I felt feelings that I hadn't been able to I still can't put into words, but they were like very potent feelings that you normally don't feel when you're watching, I don't know, like a series. And so I think that's what we're trying to get better at doing. I mean, I think it's going to be it's a lifetime. You have to build craftsmanship of trial and error, of trying something, it not working, trying something and it did work. This was a small example for me that it worked. You know, Homer is remembering something that is both completely antithetical to what he's experienced as a psychiatrist, and yet it feels like the truth. And I don't know, I feel that feeling sometimes in my life. I mean, clearly not at that extreme, not that, you know, not the way that we've dramatized it.
I love what you're saying, because I feel like culturally speaking, we throw away a lot of the feelings that we can't explain or narrativize. And what's so bizarre about that is, like, I mean, I think we can all probably agree that time is not linear, and yet we convince ourselves that our feelings like must be linear, but like why? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was an incredibly powerful moment, because it felt like Homer's consciousness had been suppressed, and that it was all and it was like, you know, gushing, suddenly gushed out at that moment. So I felt that, the power of that totally, yeah. Because you're waiting for him to come on, just realize, remember, you know, remember the OA, remember prayer, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes those moments are just about a couple of things lining up, a certain quality of light, a gesture. You know, for Homer, of course, being in an enclosed glass space again, and like her hand against the glass, and all, you know, and the spiral staircase in front of him, and all of that aligns in a moment and is a trigger to unlock what has been repressed. And whether you're dealing with multiple dimensions or timelines or not, like, that definitely happens, you know, in a single timeline, in a single dimension, where you have kept a memory locked in your heart. And then suddenly a certain smell or a certain piece of music.
Or syzygy of events. Like the lining, lining up of certain events completely opens that memory up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things, is that like deja vu, memory, feeling of having known someone, feelings of like ghosts, or that you know, that you're connected to people. All these things. Film is a great way to sort of try to get at some of these feelings, or try to dramatize them. And so we're interested in that in our work, and we're interested in just trying to figure out ways of showing that just for ourselves. I mean, I think it just interests us, let alone the audience, and hopefully some people in the audience like it too.
Oh God, yeah, yeah. Quickly on a practical level, so you presumably had to film that final scene. It looked in England somewhere. Where did you film that, and how did that happen?
That's Twickenham.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's Twickenham soundstages, and we went and really filmed him, Paddy Gibson, chasing the ambulance.
Wow. Well, and can you give us an idea of what the cast felt like when they did they respond when you gave them that final scene in the script? How they I mean, their minds must have been blown as well.
Yeah, we didn't really do that. We didn't really give it to anybody. Okay. Most people who had it were the crew didn't even really have it. I think they were kind of confused to what was going on. We just wanted to keep it a secret. And so Britt and I explained the ending to Patty. And I remember going out to dinner with Jason and explaining it to him. So Patty and Jason were in the know. And of course, our cinematographer, production designer, producers knew. But I don't think a lot of other – I don't think the rest of the cast – did they know, Britt?
Maybe Ian. You know, but I think
I think
Ian and Kareem and stuff. But I think no, I think for everybody, we're just living in a new universe now in which things are like very suddenly easily disseminated all over the world in an instant. You know, so if you have an ending that is it. Really going to be a lot more fun for the audience if they don't see it coming. Then it's funny, you have to go to some lengths to protect that these days.
Oh yeah, it's incredible to pull off like a proper surprise thing, isn't it? Yeah, in any kind of pop culture kind of thing, it's an extraordinary achievement, really. Yeah. another things I've got to quick ask you about. I have to ask you about the robots doing the movements. A, the little ones that Elodie has are fantastic, and the whole character of Elodie as well. Like and then the big versions of in that final thing. Did you always have in mind that you would have these robots and how and why actually did that? Why do they exist? Why does she have those instead of? Can you answer that at all? Rather than have people doing them?
I can't answer that, but I just wanted to take a moment to talk about Irène Jacob, the amazing actress who plays Elodie. When we were younger, we admired her work so much, the work she'd done with Krzysztof Kieslowski, and just her performances in films. So the idea that we were lucky enough to work with her was a big honor for us, a big moment for me and Britt. And she really came so prepared. I don't know. She just brought an authenticity, a realism. Her work in both Krzysztof Kieslowski's Rouge or Red, which is his final movie, and also in The Double Life of Veronique. I don't know if you've seen either of these films, but they touch on the metaphysical. They were hugely influential to us. And she sort of, as a guru of the metaphysical, working with us, it was just super exciting. And yeah, the robots was interesting. I think we were fascinated by the idea of what do the movements feel like when it's not human bodies doing them, but machines doing them? Machine versus nature interests us. Mm. I don't know much more to say.
I guess only also that we loved the idea of a character suddenly appearing who knows a lot more than Hap. You know, like I love when you throw Hap into sharp relief. Like I think when you meet Leon in his mentor in part one, it really does that. You're like, wait, there's somebody, there's a badder baddie than Hap, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I think with Elodie, it's like, oh, wow. She's coming in with a technology that feels truly alien. And for me, it just also puts the whole dimension in sharp relief because you're like, oh, I thought we were so smart with our iPhones and our satellites and our, you know, rocket ships. And then here arrives this woman from another dimension where their technology is very far ahead of ours. And in fact, we were saying that to the wonderful sound team we worked with. We were like, whatever sounds you guys pull to like give these tiny robots a voice, it has to be not the sounds you would think they have. It should be like the sound of a future technology. And so they had fun coming up with that. I think she grounds it all and makes it all feel real. I mean, as Zal was saying, we were tremendously inspired by her. I honestly, when Zal told me to watch Red when we were in college, she was like, you've got to see this film. And I can really honestly say that it was her performance in that movie that even made me interested in the idea of acting. And so to get to play in a scene opposite her was for me, it's like I can retire. I'm done.
Yeah, she's incredible. Yeah. Also, yeah. And does she need? So I'm fascinated that Elodie has sex with Hap, and is that a key element she need to have sex with him somehow to maybe power the robots or something? That felt like something that needed to happen for her.
She was just saying that feeling and sex is often a quick way to feel something. That feeling is crucial to powering. You know, OA had said in part one that you have to move with perfect feeling. I think the idea that you need to be feeling something in order to jump is kind of part of the
mythology.
Yeah.
Mm, absolutely. I haven't mentioned Kareem. Brilliant performance by Kingsley Benadire, and whole new central character who starts off as, you know, this kind of film noir detective and then ends up. What we want, I won't ask you to. I'm thinking, you know, is he might be the OA's brother, or he's some kind of key element in her existence, isn't he? Again, it was that you wanted to have a big new character element in part two, driving a whole new section of the story, if you like, and then tying in at the end.
Yeah, I mean, Kingsley, my goodness, Kingsley Benadire, what an amazing human being and performer. There's so many moments for me that, especially the ending, I think he brought something to that role that nobody else could have brought to the role. And it was.
Yeah. And it could have easily not worked. And he made those moments feel real. You felt like there was some sort of evolution from him. There's a real thrill to film noirs, especially today, because film noirs are all about the anxiety of time and place. And gosh, I feel a lot of anxiety about time and place these days. The bummer for me in Brit is that almost every film noir ends with, you know, the violent death and destruction of the femme fatale, you know, of the female, the only female character generally. So, you know, whether they're shot in the eye or hanged or, you know, shot at the uterus or, you know, it's bad. Like, it's not even an exaggeration to say that, like, a misogynistic ending is kind of a requirement for the genre. And so we, of course, were not interested in that. We were interested in the idea instead that the detective and the female character were co-detectives, and that at the end, you know, she needs to show him something. It's him trusting her way of seeing the world, which at first seems ludicrous to him, which helps him solve the case, which I think is a good metaphor for all of us about, you know, uniting our masculine and feminine sides. Like, I don't think we need to kill the female side of us at the end. I think we can actually integrate with it, and that can be a way of solving the case, or solving ourselves, or whatever it is a metaphor for.
Yeah, completely. I wanted to mention the house, which seems to tie in with, you know, the idea, this the kind of almost like there's a mythology of this very special space, and of spaces being portals, and just the idea of humans, I guess, needing spaces. Is that fair? Is that partly what this is about? And what was the genesis of having this very important literal house, this space that becomes key and almost becomes is part of a mystery as well, part of the whole mystery to be solved?
I think if we answer that, it takes away from the fun of it. But yeah, I think yes to everything you said.
Okay.
They're all applicable.
And we're running out of time, so I'll just ask you a few kind of fairly trivial but important questions to me. The music, I mean, the original music, but also the Duran Duran's Ordinary World. I mean, one of my favourite songs. Why did you decide to use that song in the show?
That's our editor, one of our editors, and he put the song on at... And we just loved it.
Alex, yeah. It's funny. One of the things that I love so much about filmmaking in this way is that it's so intensely collaborative. You're all really writers and authors together. You know, an editor can take a crack at a scene and they can really rewrite the scene, you know, 700 to 700 different ways. And that authorship is so important. When Alex came up with that idea, for the Duran Duran song, he was adding something to Homer's character that we hadn't written in, you know? And so we author the character, then Emery authors it further, then Alex authors it further, then the score comes in and takes it to another. And so I love that aspect of filmmaking. I love that it's collective authorship. And I love that he liked that song because it's a nice moment of, for me, I think comic relief throughout what right. Homer is listening to, you know?
Yeah, it's a funny scene, exactly. It's very funny, yeah. It's brilliant. Another funny moment is in his date, when he goes on the date and Stranger Things is referenced with a reference to the Upside Down, which I loved. Was that, because you know there are, among the many, I'm sure you know, there's loads of theories on this set. One of the theories is that the OA occupies the same universe as Stranger Things. Was that a reference to that, or was that just a fun line? And a realistic line, because people would be talking about Stranger Things.
I don't know how you want us to answer that.
I think what we loved in that scene was just the idea that, like, Homer goes on this date with somebody who is very fascinated by death. And so she's sort of a ready and willing, like, fellow to go there and talk about this stuff with him.
Yeah, and I think it's also a foreshadowing for the ending of part two. She's talking about stories in one space, and what if those two spaces intersect, which is what is the promise we're leaving the viewer with at the cliffhanger of end of part two.
Right, absolutely, yeah. No, that's a good answer. That's a perfect answer. Now, Jason Isaacs says, and he says a few times, he told me that you've mapped out, you know, five, I think he says, seasons or parts of this story. Is that right? And for you, have you planned all that out meticulously, or is it more, can you change it around and can you do it differently to that necessarily?
Well, I mean, I think that we, before we ever began this endeavor and before we ever sold anything to Netflix, we wanted to sort of figure out the tent poles of multiple seasons, have a beginning, middle, and end to the story so that we wouldn't invest years of our life and the viewer wouldn't invest days of their lives watching it and not have some sort of, we wanted to be responsible storytellers. So we did some mapping. Yeah. I mean, it was fun and we're grateful for it. You know, it was a neat experience. We showed the first two chapters at LACMA, a little premiere right before it launched, the week of its launch. And at the end of chapter one of part two, when OA encounters Homer and then you see the other captives and then he takes her to go see Dr. Percy, the audience in the theater gasped. And that was sweet to see, because while we had known it for years, it was like a message coming from the sun. It had taken so many years for what we already knew for the audience to experience it. And the fact that, at least I have no idea what the general public feels or the Netflix audience feels, but at least the audience in that theater was sort of like excited for that moment of storytelling. And so I was grateful to me and Britt that we had, I felt lucky that we had taken the time to figure out the story before we'd ever started. Sorry, I'm rambling.
No, I mean, I guarantee you every single person watching it has felt that incredible gasp. It's like it's an incredible moment. Yeah, yeah. In terms of, you can't say, for definite what's happening with the next part, but have you, because I know you write, you wrote the whole of all the scripts for each part were written, weren't they, before you filmed them, like you film a movie. So can you even say how far you are down with the actual nitty gritty of writing the next part?
Not a stitch.
Okay.
Not a stitch.
Yeah, I'm in the phase, Boyd, of just going to the dentist, trying to fix my car, doing the laundry that I haven't done for 5 years, you know. But no, it would be, of course, we would love to continue the story, and we would love in any form to tell where we have seen it going, you know. But
sure.
That's all in the air, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do that. And thanks so much. I think, I'm fair in saying for everyone that I know that's watched it, it's one of our favourite things that we've ever seen on TV. It's just an incredible, already, you know, even only two parts in, we're already, only, you know, two parts in, our minds have been blown, and it's just an incredible thing. Thank you very much.
That was Britt Marling and Zaubat Manglij finally pulling back the curtain slightly. Boyd, is everything now clear to you?
No, but I don't want it to be. It's slightly, well, it's not, everything, they answered everything I wanted to know, kind of like, yeah, how the, you know, it's the oldest question in the book, isn't it? How do you come up with these ideas? And, you know, trying to eke that out, I think is fascinating, yeah. And they're very, very good at talking about that stuff, I think.
I'm astonished the first question out of your mouth was, tell us about the sex-powered robots. I need to know
That's not strictly true.
Though that was a really fascinating answer they gave, that the robots are powered by emotion. So when she says she needs fuel, she needed emotional fuel.
Yeah, that was,
I thought that was a lovely, yeah, that was a lovely fact.
Yeah, so those are the little robots that do the movements, that Elodie, the character of Elodie, which has the same, played by Irene Jacob, this legendary actress, that she has, and that she, when she has sex with Hap, Dr. Hap, she then collapses, doesn't she? And then
she does.
So it's that is an incredible scene, yeah, one of many. But she does have sex with
also him. Also super creepy because he's prepared that syringe of sedative. Yes. He's clearly planning to kidnap her and imprison her, and she's like, "Nah, mate, I'm gone."
Yeah, it's like his default option is to kidnap and imprison people.
Yeah, he's problematic on so many levels, isn't he?
So problematic.
Man, just sit down and have a conversation. Seriously, you don't need a syringe.
Yeah.
Well, let's start off with what you thought. Now, I know you love this. So when you got to the end of this, when you saw the final scene, what did you think?
Yeah, so I think I was elated. I'm going to use that word because I've banged on about relentlessly the fact that I went, had a day on set of this show. Yeah. Right? I'm never going to stop talking about it.
What day was that? Tell us now.
Right, so that they were filming two different episodes with two different directors. So Zal was directing one episode. Mm. Which I think was episode 2 off the top of my head. And then it was episode 7 was the other episode I saw some of being filmed, which is filmed by a director called Anna Rose Holmer, who's directed indie films before. So that's the penultimate episode. And one of the scenes, remember there's a dream sequence that begins the episode with like a glass coffin. And you remember that scene where Nina is in a forest? I saw that being filmed. So yeah, they filmed this extraordinary dream sequence. So that, which was pretty incredible itself, because that had a lot of elements to it. It had a woman in a black rubber outfit in a glass coffin, basically, and the OA and Britt Marling in this extraordinary outfit, and the little Russian girl who was her as a child. Mm. All of these things. So I watched that being done at the end of the day and being filmed in a very ambitious way by Zal, and it was all quite. It was pretty incredible to watch that. And then I also got to watch the character of Kareem, kind of when he goes back to that house, both first when he arrives at that house in the forest and when he goes back to it as well.
Yes.
Both of those scenes. Remember, he ends up having to go into the lake.
Yeah.
So I didn't actually go into the lake.
Ab shot.
Very good choice. It's ab shot of fit, buff Kingsley.
Yeah.
That was really interesting because I got to meet Liz Carr, who played that character of Marlowe, this kind of scientist figure who helped develop all the dreamers.
Yeah, dreaming. She's been working with Pierre Ruskin.
Yeah, working with Pierre Ruskin. And she's an amazing figure. She's in Silent Witness on British TV. That's where people recognise her from. But she's an amazing person in her own right. And, you know, she was fantastic. And she recognised me from being on Sky's Oscars coverage.
Oh,
how excited was that? So I got this.
Allowed to go on to the OA and immediately make instant celebrity friends.
I already made instant celebrity friends. She's amazing. So I got to see these two quite different things, and I got to see Jason Isaacs hump the body up the side of the forest. Do you remember that bit as well? Do you remember when he's killed? So that bit. So I got to see, so I had spent quite a lot of time with Jason as well, and he was obviously I meant to ask Zal and Britt where they knew about the whole Hello Jason Isaacs thing from Entertainment, but I forgot to ask them that. They'll probably have gone, "What the fuck?
They've gone,
what
are you talking about, Boyd?"
So it was. All the different, I felt like I saw so many different elements. I got to see Jason, I got to see Kareem, I got to see her, and just generally watching the way they work, which is unbelievable as well. This like kind of collegiate thing where everyone's joining in, giving ideas, and they're both kind of working stuff out, the best way to film stuff. It was absolutely incredible. What question am I answering? Oh, yeah. The ending.
Yes.
So what they said to me, one of the really interesting things they said to me was they really loved the fact, I banged on about this title sequence thing. So very first episode, the title sequence arrives 62 minutes in or something. And I loved that so much, like beyond all reason. Because that's a spine, for me, that was a spine tingling moment.
Yeah,
tingling moment.
Absolutely.
And they were like, yes, we wanted it to be. We meant it absolutely to have that power. And coming up with these powerful, spine tingling, incredible moments, almost ecstatic moments, was what they're aiming for. And how hard it is. And they're talking about how hard it is that this stuff curses them in their mind. They've got to write it in their script and then film it somehow. And just the kind of, not pain, but the difficulty of that is part of the whole, you know, incredible creative process. And they also said that there's a more twisty labyrinth in season two. It wants it to be like a labyrinth and like a kind of different mysteries. So there's the mystery of the disappearing person, of the house, of how these people connect with the OA, of what the OA is, of what the different dimensions. There's so many different mysteries, right? Which is why I think they chose the noir genre as another genre. But they went, but we wanted an ending to have to be satisfying. We didn't want to lead you up to something and then not leave the audience like hanging. They were very firm about wanting to, and I felt the ending was managed to be mind-blowing, as I keep using that word, incredibly audacious, thought-provoking, because it now you think, well, how do they follow that? How does that impact on the third season, which we must have? So it did all of these things. And I can't think of a better way of achieving all of those objectives of just blowing people's minds, making people lust desperately after the next part of the story, and just shocking us in this incredibly pleasurable way. So it's like, I genuinely think it's one of my favourite things in TV history.
Well, let's talk about the ending since we brought it up. Now, it's an incredible thing that happened. So having solved the puzzle of the house, Kareem looks through the rose window, which is a window which essentially transcends dimension. He can see through and he sees into what we're calling the London dimension, the third dimension.
Twickenham.
Which is, in fact, Twickenham, yes. Yeah. It's a Twickenham dimension.
Yeah.
We see into, that's what the house is. The whole mystery is you get to see Twickenham.
Exactly.
That's essentially the goal of it.
Yeah.
We've solved the whole mystery right here.
Totally.
So he sees the mystery. Now, we see in the video footage, Michelle, the character of Michelle, goes up, she looks through the window and then collapses. Now, I suppose we're supposed to understand that her consciousness somehow has gone through into the Twickenham dimension and is now inhabiting, or at least cohabiting, the body of Ian. And then by calling Michelle's name, Kareem beckons Ian. He climbs up and then the second that he crosses the boundary, Michelle's consciousness goes back and she's back in her body. So he solves that mystery.
Yeah.
He gets her back. But in doing so, the bird flies through.
Yes.
And here's where it all gets a bit crazy. It knocks OA out of the invisible river. She falls down. Britt bangs her head. Jason Isaacs comes in. And suddenly we're left with the moment that, you know, because we can see the set. We've looked down. We've seen, you can see the set of Kareem's houseboat. You can see, you know, the set of where they've done the movements. He comes down. And you see that brilliant moment where Hap is in Jason Isaacs' body. He realizes that it's Britt when they use her name. And then I get the impression in this, because we talked about how they talked about suppressing consciousness, didn't they? That when you go into a host body, you can suppress their consciousness or you can coexist with it. And I think it becomes clear in this that Hap is kind of, if not coexisting with Jason Isaacs, at least has access to his thoughts.
Yes.
Because he immediately knows who he is.
Yes.
And he says, I'm Jason Isaacs.
Yes. In a slightly weird accent, which I also think is key.
I think Jason Isaacs has spoken about that. He was trying to twist his head around. He was trying to act the part of Hap being inside Jason Isaacs and accessing Jason Isaacs' voice, but he's still Hap.
Yeah,
so amazing. I think he deliberately skewed the accent slightly, which is an incredible bit of mind-bending.
And by the way, you know he does. He keeps in accent when he's playing an American.
Yes, yes, he does.
So, and that I can testify to that, because when I interviewed him in the recording interview, he is doing it in American.
Oh, really?
Accent. Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's weird.
But that's a bit. So he gets in there. Now, it's worth noting, this is not our Twickenham. This is not our reality.
No.
This is a reality in which Britt Marling and Jason Isaacs are married, which of course they are not in real life, because as they've said, there are echoes.
Yes.
So their relationship between the OA and Hap has echoed through dimensions, and this has happened. And then, just because that wasn't mind-bending enough, they're in the ambulance, and suddenly Steve opens the door, comes in, sits down, looks at Hap and says, hello, Hap.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Totally.
In fact, that's literally what I texted you when I saw this. I was like, Boyd, what the actual fuck?
Yes. So I think that's it. I think that's why another element to why it's so brilliant is because, okay, so we've got the idea, we're trying to work out what they're getting at is that, you know, they're now talking about that this is a film set and a show is being filmed with Britt Marling and Jason Isaacs in it, but it's not exactly reality, our reality, as you say, because these two are married. And it does reflect upon the whole story so far, and all the big theme of storytelling, and of the people, that the idea of deja vu and everything. So it's not like coming out of nowhere. It's not gratuitous. That's right. So not only does it all do the things I went on about just now, it also makes sense thematically. Does. Now, I think obviously we don't yet know why Steve calls him Hap, and why, you know, I think it's all part
Steve
of
has never seen Hap.
Right, exactly.
But then, as some people have posited on the internet, is that 100% Steve, who we think has made the jump? Or they said, could it be Homer, his consciousness in the body of Twickenham Steve?
Right. I think what we do know already is, well, I think they've made it clear, you know, ish, is that, well, no, they have made it clear, is that all of these people who are going from one dimension to another, some people are aware. So Homer isn't aware of his previous one. Then he finally does become aware, as we talked about.
Because you get the impression that he jumped, but for one reason or another, his consciousness ended up being suppressed by the host's consciousness until he gets triggered by the glass elevator.
Right. And then the OA, so Nina, you know, Nina wasn't aware of Prairie. And then in this one, and then I think she was told, wasn't she, by Elodie. Elodie said, it was Old Knight, wasn't it, who said, you're not going to be aware. And that could be a problem in the next version of you. And
that's right.
So them all, it has, there's different versions of how it all works. I don't think we know why necessarily. We certainly know there are different ways of going from one dimension to another, and that impacts in different ways. And there's different levels of consciousness. And there are people like BBA, who seems to be able to be aware now of all the different people.
She can sense across dimensions.
She senses across dimensions. Yes. And Kareem can see across dimensions.
Through the rose window.
Because he sees the whole picture. That was the overview, which is the title, I think, of that last episode. And who is he? You know, it's hinted that she's got a brother, or it's mentioned that she's got a brother. Is he the brother? Why is his face the thing that all the people, the dreamers, could see?
That's right. Yeah.
And so that's the incredible achievement for me of that ending, is that it does tie these things together thematically without, of course, still bewildering us and making us confused and setting us up for the next chapter. But it works so perfectly thematically and in tying lots of things together. It's an incredible achievement.
It's layered all the way through this. As you say, it's when Old Knight gives the OA an NDE, Old Knight sends her into the Twickenham future where she's on a plane. And she's on a plane, and the person speaking on the plane is speaking in an English accent. So we can only assume that is flight BA411, which is, of course, what Kareem uses to solve one of the game puzzles. Unfortunately, I've Googled it. BA411 is a flight from Belgium to London. So I'm just saying it wouldn't be in San Francisco. But that's not
the end of it. She could have flown, but she goes to see a woman with a short hair, presumably Britt Marling.
Yes,
Britt Marling is clearly doing a press trip in Belgium
and she's
for Netflix.
And
she's flying back.
That's right.
And you know, it's set in Amsterdam. Netflix is centered in Amsterdam in Europe.
It's all tied together, boy. It's all tied together.
Amsterdam's not in Belgium, is it? It's in Holland, sorry. my geography went crazy there for a minute. I got overexcited.
But there's more. There's more. So the other layers, we've seen the bit where when Scott recounts his NDE, in the same way that Homer's NDE took him to the San Francisco dimension, Scott's NDE took him to Twickenham. Because he says, and his literal quote is, he says, lights were everywhere. We were in a warehouse. I saw OA. It was her and not her. Hap didn't call her OA. He called her Bryn or something.
Yeah.
He said something to her. She laughed and kissed him like they were a couple. There were cameras in the air above them. Hap called out to someone, but his voice was different. He spoke with a British accent. See, it's like reading it now, it seems incredibly obvious what that's alluding to. But of course, when it happens in the show, you just take it on board as just another crazy thing. You don't think of it. You don't think it through. Whereas Bryn, clearly, Brit.
Yeah, completely. And that's funny as well. And one of the things, I read one review which accused the show, I mean, absolutely terrible. I think it was in The Guardian, actually, and accused the show of being slightly humorless and po-faced, which I think people said before about the first series. But I think that is funny. They foreshadow it by her being called Bryn.
Yeah.
You know, I was tempted to mention that, to call her Bryn throughout the interview, but I stopped myself. I thought it might completely backfire. But there are moments like that that foreshadowing. A, it's so clever, you know, I can only imagine the post-it notes and the threads as they're working out the narrative and working out the scripts. But those moments are so brilliantly done. Yeah, those.
It's funny how this season built on the mythology of the first one so much. So when you end season one, you're never 100% sure whether or not she's telling the truth. The whole point of season one is she a reliable narrator or is she not?
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the box of books under the bed and you are unclear exactly. at the end whether she has died
yeah.
or whether she has gone to another dimension. I think the answer to that question very much lay with Netflix, which is if you cancel it, she's dead. If you pick it up again, she went to another dimension. And the very first episode of this one clearly solves that biggest mystery. Is she for real? Yes, she is.
Yeah, because Jason, I remember Jason Isaacs said as well that he read the script. Remember, you know, he wasn't the first choice of this role. He's very open about this. You know the story?
Who was the first choice?
We don't know. So he would know. That's unprofessional. So he won't say who was the first choice, but he's very clear that it was very last minute. I think they hired someone. It wasn't going to work out. They knew it wasn't going to work out for whatever reason. They sent him the script like 2 days before they were starting filming in New York. And he stayed up all night to read the script. Absolutely blew his mind. And he said, only on reading halfway through filming, I think, season one, that he suddenly thought, I might not exist. I might be a figment of the OA's imagination because she might be making this whole thing up. And there was always that element, wasn't there, to part one, that it could all be. They planted that. But I love the fact that they got that out of the way.
Immediately. Explain the books.
Yep. And there was like, oh, great. And it was very, and that was a very satisfying theme because I think you have to get out of the way because otherwise you'd be distracted by that because it gets so weird with Old Night and the tree, the internet
trees.
You don't
want to be wondering whether or not
right, you don't.
Real.
And I think that's kind of what I was trying to mention that when I was talking about the ending as well. It all kind of makes sense. And that's why people compare it to Twin Peaks. And particularly Twin Peaks, I think the return, you know.
Yes.
Which I did love. I know
which
you did. I know you hate. I loved it. But for me, this is a much bigger achievement. I know it's slightly childish to compare, but I'm going to. Because it does have those mind-blowing things happening that Twin Peaks has, particularly like visual things that seem to come out of nowhere. Suddenly a psycho octopus arrives, right? But actually, this is more grounded. This has more, because it has that narrative basis established. I think it just feels, I'm buying into it. I'm believing in the fucking octopus and the internet of trees and the idea of faith. And I'm the most atheistic, you know, I don't believe in anything. You know, I don't believe in anything supernatural or anything. But I totally buy into this. And Twin Peaks, I love it and I'm entertained by it, but it doesn't feel like it's trying to make me believe in it as thing.
No, I don't believe Twin Peaks has a grounded underlying mythology.
Exactly.
I think it's, frankly, drivel for drivel's sake.
Right, I wouldn't agree with that. But it's definitely entertainment for entertainment and surrealism for surrealism's sake.
Yeah.
Whereas this feels like, oh my God, they're definitely, not, you know, without using that phrase, they're trying to say something. There's definitely ideas they're exploring and they're finding mind-blowing ways to do it. I keep using the phrase mind-blowing, but what other phrases
is there? No, it is mind-blowing. I mean, this is Terry Pratchett's Trousers of Time writ large in TV format.
I was about to say the same.
Of course. What I like about this show is like it starts you off like there's a game and it is quite grounded. Like you're on board with this. And I think the second they introduce Old Night, like Old Night for me is a signpost. It's like, okay, I hope you're strapped in because this, you know, the roller coaster is about to hit the downturn. Like this is going to go nuts.
Absolutely.
Then we have mind flowers, internets of trees, windows that look through dimensions, puzzle houses, doors that disappear, you know, a medium and an engineer, complete and utter craziness from that point on. What I also liked, and we talked about this, we touched on this in the regular podcast, that there were things we couldn't talk about. And we weren't allowed to say ahead of time that Zendaya was in this.
Oh yeah, I meant to ask them about that.
Yeah, that was a secret. Her involvement was something that they wouldn't talk about.
Yes.
As one of the people in the house.
Again, I think that just shows they like surprises. I mean, they talked about, you know, it's hard in this day and age. I think that, you know, we touched upon this, to give viewers satisfying things they don't know about and to keep secrets in this day and age. I remember, you know, Stephen Moffat goes on about this a lot, that part of they were trying to do all the way through Sherlock, and a bit why some people, and I don't agree with them, got slightly annoyed by it, was because it was trying to pull the rug from under us a lot.
Yeah.
And I feel that's what they're doing with this, and trying to find out the most emotionally connected way to do that. And even and casting Zendaya, who is a massive iconic figure, particularly for young people, I think, like globally, is a huge thing. Keeping it a secret is an even more brilliant thing. So I think that, it's just purely for that, to keep like very, to add to the pleasure of the experience. It's very interesting because some creative people often say, I'm not writing it for anyone, don't they? They're like, oh, you know, I'm just writing it for myself. I think Zahl and Britt, I get the sense that they're very, very aware of coming up with ways of pleasing us, of making it an incredibly enjoyable viewing experience as well as a thought-provoking one.
But they have tapped into that. Like, there are key moments in this from the very first episode of the first season, as you've mentioned before, the titles that comes in. That is a real emotional gut punch moment.
Right.
And there are so many of those in this. You know, that and Zal articulated that really well, just like that bit where Homer's consciousness emerges and he's like, and he's in the glass elevator. That is so emotionally powerful.
Yeah.
And there are so many beats like this. Like, they really know how to push viewers' buttons. Like the moment when OA and Kareem are figuring out the puzzles in the house. It's just an amazing idea. That house, the game, how Q Symphony ties into this house, which happens to be built on poisonous gas, but also was created by these two people, the medium and the engineer, to essentially give people a window into another dimension. And I love the aspects of mythology, like you can look through the window and it's fine, but you have to have completed the puzzle of the house for the window to work. You have to have come up through the house properly.
Yes.
You can't just wander up to the window and look out
at it. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like they were saying how, you know, the collaboration, everything about that, the design, the meticulousness of it is brilliantly done, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like actually, like in any other way, like there are a lot of scenes in the middle part of the series of Britt and Kareem, of the OA and Kareem, kind of together traveling through spaces, aren't they?
Yeah,
and trying to work it.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, it kind of worked because, like, you're watching them discover what's happening. Mm. You know, like the contrast with this and like something like Westworld. For me, like Westworld got really irritating in season two because you're like, it's constantly just showing you stuff, bewildering stuff, and implying there's lots of different dimensions and different versions of all these different characters and beating you around the head with the mystifying nature of it. Whereas for me, why the OA is different is because you're taken through the mysteries in front of you. I'm not really expressing this, but do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You're enjoying the journey with the characters almost. And like, so whereas I feel with something like Westworld, it's a puzzle and I feel like I'm aware of the writers putting it together, whereas you're totally immersed. That's it's immersive for me, the OA.
But I also get the impression from this that you believe watching the OA that Britt and Zal have this mythology worked out, that they know exactly the answer to all your questions, whether or not they choose to share the answers. With so many other shows, you know, from Westworld, you get the impression that they are teasing an audience with mysteries for the sake of having mysteries, you know, and maybe they've got answers, maybe they don't, and in all likelihood they're making up as they go along. You don't get the impression that there's something inside the puzzle box. In Westworld, I think the puzzle box is its own sake.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's an empty,
nothing inside.
Right, it's the opposite of empty, isn't it? This is like a full.
Yes.
This is a full.
There's so much shit. There are psychic octopuses inside the puzzle box. Yeah. There's a load of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like, we didn't even touch that much when I talked to them about how, you know, they kept the BBA and the gang of teenagers separate. In their episodes, they're completely separate.
Completely separate.
Which I found completely satisfying because there were like two, again, I read reviews that went, oh, you know, you can't just kind of take time out from the narrative, and it was annoying because, you know, you build up to a big thing and then suddenly you have these 2 hours which are almost like a different feel, and they are directed by Andrew Haig, who's a brilliant director, but they are like an indie, you know, like teen indie drama comedy thing, and they're very, I thought they were incredibly moving
and
beautiful, like beautifully filmed, you know, the scene where they all run into the sea, which is like, oh, it really captured like freedom of teenagers, like finding some kind of freedom in their friendship. I love the fact they none of them ever phone their parents. They all talk about it. They go on and on about it. And BBA keeps saying, you have phoned your parents, haven't you? And they go, yeah. And they still, and it's like, that was so clever because, like, you wouldn't. You're so entranced by this new world. So I loved those episodes. And I loved how they let him direct them in a way that was like slightly different feel, but also within the world of the OA. And I like the fact that you just took time out with them. I thought they were absolutely brilliant. I love the whole thing, which is partly why I asked about, you know, the character of French making him gay. I thought that was I just thought they really let them breathe and gave. And I think I love those characters. But I think people have said they're one dimensional, the teen characters. But I don't think they are at all.
I think
used an incredible limited amount of dialogue in a way. But I felt I get to know all of them. I fucking love those people.
But it's
BBA
nice,
particularly.
But you could have left those characters behind as they were literally left behind, and you
right.
could have forgotten them.
Exactly.
And I love that they didn't.
No.
And I think the people who didn't like those two particular episodes focused solely on them were possibly the people who fundamentally didn't like, you know, the episode from season two of Stranger Things.
Yes.
You know, when 11 goes off and does
exactly.
her own thing.
Exactly.
And I feel like they get in their head that they have a goal in mind. Like, I want to see this story play out, and any deviation from that is a distraction.
Yeah.
And I think if this played out week by week, if this was a weekly installment thing, those episodes would be annoying.
Right, like, exactly.
Because they would derail. You think, well, now you've just wasted a week of my time. I now don't know what's happening. But it isn't. It's just, it's an hour interlude, and it's a beautiful interlude. And then the next one is there for you afterwards.
Yeah, completely. So yeah, you're right. Fine. Yeah, people got ridiculously angry, didn't they, about the episode of Stranger Things.
I loved that episode
I thought it was really, but I thought it was a really interesting, and I totally appreciated what they were doing. And I, but I think even more so in this case, I loved them. Individually, equally. I just think that interrelationship between BBA and those kids is so moving. Yeah. The casting, which, I mean, that, you know, I know, sure, obviously they're showing us a gig to go on about how much they love their cast, but Paddy Gibson as Steve is fucking incredible.
He's very, very good.
Ian Alexander, as you know, that's a really interesting thing that they got Ian Alexander, who's a trans actor, young trans actor, playing a character who is one point a boy and at one point a girl, and when you, and it's so important, isn't it, when you first see that photo of the missing person that Kareem is trying to find, that you're like, oh, you kind of recognize, but you're not sure. And that's key. They needed Ian Alexander for that, you know, they needed someone like that. It's so interesting, I think.
One of the questions, and we'll get on some listener questions in a minute, but one of them was like, how long did it take you before you twigged that Michelle was Buck? And frankly, it took me too long. Like, it was, I was a bit embarrassed when I was
I think that's, but it's supposed to be like that. No, but I think you're supposed to have like deja vu. I think they mentioned the deja vu thing, which I got, I think you're going, oh, is that, I recognize that kind. It's brilliantly handled.
I twigged when she twigged. When she goes Buck, I went, oh, it is Buck. Like, it totally didn't twig with me.
No, and so I kind of thought it might be, but I wasn't sure. And I let it kind of hover in my mind. But I'm the same. I think that's exactly how it's supposed to work.
Can I just say, I want to see a dimension where there's more from Mo, pregnant Mo, who's amazing and underused in this.
Yeah, no, Mo is incredible. I agree. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. And you know, I'm trying to think of, I want to mention Phyllis Smith. Playing BBA, absolute legend. Yeah,
well, Phyllis Smith, very, very good.
And Emery Cohn as Homer.
Yeah,
I mean, my God, you know, just
he's very, very good in this.
Fucking brilliant.
I mean, the last thing I saw him in was a black metal film called Lords of Chaos, where he murderizes the shit out of a load of people.
Yeah,
he couldn't meet all he's traumatized me slightly recently, but he's very, very good in this.
And Jason Isaacs, and I think Jason Isaacs, by the way, is aware that this is one of the most special things he's ever done.
Oh yeah, without
I think
a doubt.
He's very, very
And he's had a storied career. I've got loads of time for Jason Isaacs. He's brilliant in literally everything he's ever done.
Yeah. So. But he's been in some, as he himself would say, he's been in some dodgy stuff.
But always elevated them.
Oh, totally elevated them. But I think what's interesting, what I was going to say is, what's very fascinating is by the end of this second part, it's now clear, it's clear to me, and you know, I feel that him, Homer, and the OA, and Steve, I feel like those four are almost very closely entwined, and that they're gonna have to be in it all the way through. Like, how do you know what I mean? Whereas you could envisage, so you know, one character did die in the middle of, you know, one of the young characters dies from the drug, Jesse, and it's really sad and powerful. But I feel like those four need to be together throughout the rest of this thing, and maybe Kareem as well now has joined them in that. Although, you know, we're not sure if he can make it through to that dimension. How fuck knows how that's going to work.
There's a lot of unanswered questions at this point, but it's interesting. So Elodie mentions leaving echoes is dangerous,
right,
which is an interesting idea. It's like you can find yourself in a life completely unrecognisable to you. You would shatter yourself, she says. And she says, not to mention you and Homer might not even know each other in a dimension outside an echo. And she says they need Hap. So it goes back to kind of what you're saying about Steve and Homer and the OA and Hap, about they're drawn together, but they also kind of need each other to ground themselves.
Yes, yeah, completely.
Are there any other things you wish to discuss, Boyd, before I pull out some listener questions?
Just that I find it fascinating that, you know, they haven't written a jot of part three, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so that means we do have to wait. We are going to have to wait. I mean, they will recommission it. There's no way they're not going to recommission it. It's just, I mean, you know, I know, I'm pretty sure how Netflix, you know, are really pleased with the show.
Yeah, it's inconceivable to me.
That I mean, it is, I think it is, you know, it's very expensive. They have complete creative freedom. You know, the scope and ambition of it means that it's a big investment. But, I mean, it would be the most devastating, put it this way, I can't think of a more devastating loss in TV history than leaving it there. I'm constantly thinking, honestly, every time I think about it, like, how is it going to play out in part three? How does the new universe, this meta universe, Twickenham, as we're calling it, Britain, Jason together, and all that. It's going to be. It's so exciting. The idea of how you deal with that.
Will we end up on, was it BA Flight 411?
Right.
The flight from Belgium to London. Will we see the presumably Netflix press junket that she's been on in Belgium before flying back to London? Yeah. You know, how meta is this going to get?
Yeah, exactly.
Will Ted Sarandos turn up at one point? I'd love to see that.
I mean, I wouldn't mind. And the fact that I've been on set, maybe I can get a small part in it, you know.
Yeah, maybe we'll see you on set doing your visit.
Steady. I like the idea of the BBA as well, and that group somehow, you know, again, I feel like they're going to try and have to save the OA. Because remember, in this next one, he's not going to be aware of the previous versions of herself.
Well, yes, because she's been warned about this.
Yeah. So I feel like BBA and the teams and Riz Ahmed and all of these things are all going to have to and work at their best to try and show her and awake that consciousness in her. That's the sense I get.
Riz Ahmed is kind of a guide, isn't he?
Yeah.
Sort of floats around.
Yeah.
Because as you said, like our old knight says to her, in the future, you don't know who you are. You know, you forget your true nature. So presumably that's what's happening next.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, let's have some listener questions. We have one here from Elf Walking who says, hi guys, what do you think about changing of the tone from an indie vibe to stylish noir? Do you think the show will change again in future seasons? I think the answer to that is a resounding yes.
Yeah, and I think it's a good question though, because they're very clear that, you know, if the first part was, I don't know, what would you describe it? Like part indie, fantasy, phantasmagorical thing with big religious underpinning. You know, it was what it was. This part two was very much a noir. But definitely they wanted, so it's definitely like a Californian noir, like Long Goodbye style thing. And you know, with a you know, and by the way, the only noir, I think they say with a person of color as the main lead detective, and as I said, you know, a femme fatale who doesn't die at the end. And there definitely will be a genre, I think, that underpins the next part. I don't know what that genre is. I mean, maybe, you know, can you imagine it'd be like knockabout comedy or something?
It's
you know?
A carry on
I mean,
film.
They, you know, because people, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be a carry-on film, but I don't, who knows? There'll definitely be a thing, an influence.
There and will be an atmosphere.
What I love about it, I think it's not like, and it's not like, you don't watch part two and go, oh, you know, this is exactly like Long Goodbye, or this is exactly like all these film noirs. It's just a kind of underlying...
Yes, it's subtle.
It's subtle. And I think there will be an underlying genre, whatever it is, to the third part, definitely.
Yes, I agree. David Blythe says, this is a multi-part question, but the first bit, how did Stephen get there and why does he call Jason Happ when Jason calls himself Jason? Well, I think that's to signify the fact that he sees that it isn't just Jason. He sees that Happ is there. So he's aware that Happ has jumped into Jason's body. Now, whether, of course, that is in fact Steve in Steve's body or Homer in Steve's body or really anyone else in Steve's body, who knows?
But I think it is Steve's body. Yeah. I feel like he is the one who's the most devoted now to the idea of the movements and of the OA in general. So I feel it did make sense to me that he was the one. I wasn't surprised that he was the one of the group to arrive at that moment in time.
Yeah.
And of course, he's an Irish actor, Paddy Gibson. So, you know, on that level, it's like, well, yeah, you know, he might be the one who's nearby geographically.
That's very true.
Yeah. But I think he does go on the biggest journey of all the teams. And I love that character, how they've completely punctured that, you know, the toxic masculinity he's got in the first, when we first meet him, and how he's become this kind of lovely guy, basically, like caring, properly passionate, caring figure.
Yeah, he's a great character.
Yeah.
David also asks, what did BBA actually do to fulfill Rachel's command, i.e. why didn't she jump? Also, where is Rachel? that's an interesting one. So Rachel, I mean, is dead she's dead in the San Francisco dimension, but then death isn't really death, because obviously the NDEs in the first place is how we discover the existence of other dimensions. So are we to understand that death actually transitions you to another dimension? It's not just death isn't death. So Rachel seems to be sending messages through dimensions, and BBA can sense across dimensions. So, you know, they say, you know, why didn't BBA jump? That's a good question, because Rachel said it's only safe for her to go. But without her, they would never have known what was going on in the San Francisco dimension anyway. So
yeah, that's right, isn't it? Yeah, I think
she's
BBA,
integral.
Yeah, she's integral in a different way, isn't she? And it's like all the way through, I feel like partly Riz Ahmed's character is trying to make her realize her special powers, if you put it in that way, and her special role. And her, I don't feel like her jumping from one dimension to another is what she's supposed to do.
Yeah.
I feel like she is the one who's like seeing all this stuff. And I think she will have key ways of somehow being in touch with Brit / the OA as it goes forward. Yeah. I love that idea that she's got this kind of, she's this unique, special person. And also, if you go back to like the first series, you know, the OA gathering them, this group of seemingly random people. Yeah. Well, they're not, are they?
No.
And how, yeah, that, you know, again, that how that all plays out is going to be amazing.
He also asks, is Homer dead? I think Homer, as in Homer's body in the San Francisco dimension, presumably, yes, dead.
Yeah, but
Homer's consciousness, I think we can assume, has probably jumped as well.
Yeah, I think so.
But we will find out. And the last thing he says, is Renata now trapped forever in the Treasure Island? I'm going to say yes. I think Renata's... Probably. I don't think we're going to see Renata again. I think we're done. Sorry, Renata. You've had a bit of a...
Yeah, I think that is possibly true. Paz Vega, yeah, who's great as Renata, by the way. Yeah.
Another question. This is from Jenna, who says, is Elodie really cartoon?
Oh, yeah.
Or could she be the great evil OA is told she and her friends must defeat? I never got that from this. Like, cartoon, of course, is the sort of the female character she meets in the space between spaces.
Yeah,
during
in the starry
her
room.
In that starry room, thing.
Yeah.
Feeds her doves, that kind of thing.
In part one,
yeah. Yeah, so no, I got the impression that Elodie is what she claimed to be. She is a tourist. She travels from dimension to dimension.
Yeah.
How she builds those robots everywhere she goes is neither here nor there.
Yeah, I think I could have put that to them, but I thought that's too much. They won't want to go yes
no,
or no.
No,
and also I think Brit said she is from another dimension, a being from another dimension who has more, who knows so much more than Hap and everyone else, and that's kind of her significance. So I guess, but maybe but who knows, she could end up being that, the same person, the same being.
So Liam says, who do you think OA's brother is? Are we supposed to assume it's Kareem? Could it be Steve or the FBI agent? All of the above, really, isn't it? Could be any of them. But there's definitely a Kareem link, isn't there? Like, I refuse to believe we've seen the last of Kingsley Benadire in this.
Oh, no way, yeah. No, I think for me, that ending is set up like, you know, they all have to return. All those key characters have to return because they're now tied together in some key way. And he, the fact that he was the face that they all the dreamers in the thing dreamt of.
Exactly,
I mean,
that.
He is some major, important figure. And again, I mean, he could be the brother. Yeah, I mean, he could somehow.
I love that moment where you've got them all these dreamers dreaming in a room, and they all dream of a rose-stained glass window, a curved double-sided staircase, a tunnel the size of a coffin, and Kingsley Benadire.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant, yeah. Kingsley Benadire, who I never see, like to stop reminding people, is an Arsenal fan from Camden.
He's an Arsenal fan from Camden?
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Brilliant.
Right, Chris LB says, what was the first absolute what-the-fuck moment in this season? Well, I mean, that's old night, isn't it? I mean, that was a bit...
It is old night. Yeah, that's true.
I was like, Boyd, a psychic octopus?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think there are little audacious moments all the way through, obviously. You know, I like the fact that the OA mentioned that the president is... what's his name, isn't it?
It's Joe Biden.
Joe Biden,
so they jump into a well, you know, with Joe Biden as president.
So that's a little audacious moment, but the proper... The biggest, because the octopus is old night is the biggest what the fuck moment, even bigger than the climax of season one, really, of part one with the shooting and everything. Yeah, it's absolutely fucking incredible.
It's funny, a number of people I noticed on social media took real issue with the end of season one, not because it was implausible, but they felt that they thought that in using interpretative dance to stop a high school shooting was in poor taste.
Like, I think
it polarized people on so many different levels.
I mean, I never felt that genuine. I mean, obviously, I am a massive fan of the show, but it never bothered me at all. And I think what's happened since, which is that, you know, the rise of young people who are survivors of school shootings in America, and it's not my place to say so, but I just get the sense that actually, you know, that almost like weirdly prefigured, you know, but I think it was saying something about the power of young people to, you know, whether you call it faith or creativity or whatever it is they're doing. I just thought it was a really powerful, moving thing. And if you're doing something sincere, it's sincerity, isn't it? Like, it's not gratuitous and it's not cynical. It was properly sincere. So I didn't feel exploitative to me at all. Like, if I saw there have been films literally about, you know, haven't there, high school shootings.
There have.
Clearly
many.
Based on them. Mm. And that bothers me more than the ending of the OI, which I thought was totally fine.
I thought when they all get up in that cafeteria, I thought that was so, I mean, yeah. It nearly moves you to tears.
Yeah,
that
totally,
does.
Yeah. If you're moved,
powerful.
Right, exactly. And that's where you can go, isn't it? If you're moved, if you think it's powerfully moving and you move to tears, then you can't then complain that it's gratuitous and exploitive.
No, I
just don't
I
think
agree.
It is.
I yeah. didn't think it did either. Right, we have time, I think, for one more of these before we must go. And this is also from Chris W, who says, and you can start with this one, Boyd. What did you shout at your TV when you got to the ending, when they took us to the television program dimension, aka Twickenham? What did you shout, Boyd?
I think I shouted Jesus fucking Christ. I'm trying to remember what time it was. I think it was, oh no, it was in the morning, first thing in the morning, because what happened was I'd watched, so we were given... TV critics in advance were given six
yes.
parts, and so I had to watch the last two live, so to speak. So I think they dropped 8 a.m. Mm. On the Friday, and I watched them immediately that morning. So I think I was literally like, watching that bit at 10 o'clock in the morning, probably on my monitor here, and I was like, fucking, what the absolute... And you know what? This is the weird thing about Netflix, isn't it? Because you hadn't seen it yet.
No.
So I was unbelievably excited, and I wanted everyone I know to have watched it. And particularly because you're the main person I know who liked the first part as much as I did. So there is that sometimes that odd thing with Netflix that it's not as communal as you want it to be. And it is like, unlike, you know, say you're watching a linear thing on BBC One every week with Line of Duty or whatever, where you're all going, what the fuck, at the same time. You're not doing it at the same time as anyone. But what you can do is I immediately did look on social media and everyone's going, what the fuck, you know, kind of globally. It's a different kind of pleasure, but it was incredibly powerful moment. And fuck yeah, that's what I said. What did you say?
I came to Slack. Well,
oh yeah, you texted me.
I texted you as it was happening.
Yes.
You had informed me on the podcast I must text you immediately.
Yes.
And it was just Boyd, what the actual fuck?
Yeah.
In capitals.
Yeah, exactly.
And I, literally while it was going on, I was texting you while it was happening. I couldn't get my head around it.
Yeah, it's incredible.
As you said, I think these were your exact words, the most audacious bit of television ever. And genuinely, I agree with you. I think it was an incredibly bold move. I loved what they did with it. I loved how it made me feel. And I also loved the fact that you didn't get the impression that this was tagged on to the end. You got the feeling of all the pieces finally slotting into place. Because all of the foreshadowing of that moment suddenly makes sense. And
yes,
it feels
exactly.
like the culmination of a master plan. You know, when it feels so precisely calibrated.
Yeah.
Whereas so many of shows that do things like that, you get the impression where, oh, ratings are flagging, let's do something crazy. And that's not
right.
what this is about at all.
No, completely.
It feels very authentic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you do wonder, like, how do they top that?
Yeah. How do they top that? I mean, they've...
You see, I think they're confident. I think they know. Because I think that's the brilliant thing about them mapping out that in their minds they do know the beginning and ending of each chapter, as they call them, of each season. So I think they're pretty confident they've got more mind-blowing things to come.
But we've had two. If all goes to plan, there'll be another three. It took them how long to get from season one to two?
I know.
And Brits at the dentist, as she said, they haven't even started work on three.
I know.
You know, we could be...
But you're right. But equally, it's kind of the same, isn't it, with, like, you know, big film franchises.
Yeah.
I mean, how long have we been waiting for whatever Avengers, whatever it's called, Endgame?
Well, I mean, 12 months.
Oh, yeah.
That's
but
quite condensed.
Oh, I know. But, right, but I mean, going back to, like, how many years has it taken for that
saga?
Yeah,
it's taken like a decade for us to get.
Yeah, yeah. So... I think it will be all right. But yeah, it's a long way. Oh my God, it's a long way.
Seriously, can we fast track this? I need
all
three of the seasons, and I need them now.
I don't think they can fast track it because they're going to have to write the episodes, and it'll probably be even more ambitious. And
well, think about it, Boyd. In one other dimension, it's already aired. People have already seen it.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, God, yeah. You're absolutely right.
Okay, once the podcast is out, you and me, outside, find a couple of other people, we'll do the movements, and we'll see if we can get there.
Yeah,
we'll need to eat some kind of mind petal to work out where we're going.
Yeah, that'll work.
And I believe at that point, that concludes our OA spoiler special. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you don't already, then please do subscribe to the Pilot TV podcast for your weekly guide to everything worth watching in this overabundant era of peak TV. We will be back with the regular show as usual on Monday. Till then, we're off to gaze out of the rose window to get a glimpse of how this podcast went in any of the other infinite realities. Pilot out.